The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
All right, let's get started. I want to finish talking about Conrad Lawrence's Jackdaws today, and maybe I hope to be able to start with the next topic, because at the beginning of the next hour we're going to watch a video, so we'll have less time to go over some of the questions. So we just got started with this last time. The reading was from Conrad Lawrence's little book called King Solomon's Ring, published a long time ago, but very interesting descriptions of his early studies of animals. Remember, jackdaws are a crow-like corvid living in Europe. They nest in high places, not always on a cliff face, like the Kittiwake Gull, but often high in trees, and often in the area where he studied them, they nest in rooftops. They often live near humans. He starts, remember, by talking about play. I introduced this last time. If anybody gets interested in play behavior, it would be interesting to look in the recent literature and see if there are any new studies of play that have something interesting to say. If you are interested in that, and do some searches online, and please go over it with me, and I can let you know whether it's part of that would be an interesting project report. So what made jackdaws such interesting pets for this young man in Germany, Conrad Lawrence, who had liked animals since he was very young, and he was just 22 when he, in 1925, when he began studying these animals. So what were the properties that makes jackdaws interesting? Well, for one thing, like other corvids, they're very intelligent animals. What makes dogs so interesting? Well, part of it is their intelligence. Dogs are very smart. They're probably as smart as chimpanzees. Somewhat different types of intelligence. They're specialized in different ways. Yes? Dogs are probably more faithful than jackdaws, but believe me, if a jackdaw is attached, you're quite right. They will definitely stick close to one human being, and even their attack behavior is a little more specialized. They can even attack their own owner, as you will see. But yes. Whenever there's a lot of other noise, I can't understand anything.
That it really imprinted on the human and almost thought of itself as a human, like when it would walk.
Okay, that's part of their social nature. They're very social, like dogs. And like dogs, they can imprint on humans. A young dog, a puppy, as I mentioned last time, if they're socialized to humans very early, they treat humans as part of their pack. In fact, humans will be the alphas. The alpha male might be a female human, but the alpha male to a dog is the dominant animal in the pack. And that's the way some dogs, some species, become much more centered on one owner, the master, than other dogs. Some dogs just simply become attached to the whole family. But even a dog that's very, very attached, like, say, a Doberman, to one master, they're still social animals, and they live in a larger pack, and they will defend the pack. So they're a pretty good guard dog in that respect. So they're very social, they're very intelligent, and they're adapted to living near humans. And they have been for a long time. In Altenburg, Germany, where Lawrence lived at that time, there were many jackdaws living in different rooftops in the town. This is a quote from Lawrence: like the stones of a mosaic, the inherited and acquired elements of a young bird's behavior are pieced together to produce a perfect pattern. But in a bird that's been reared by hand, the natural harmony of this design is necessarily somewhat disturbed. I suppose if you're interested in natural behavior of dogs, you could say a dog's behavior is pretty disturbed by being raised by humans too. So you don't see all the natural behaviors of a dog that's become a human pet. But it's more dramatic in the case of the birds. And Lawrence goes through this. The disturbances he talks about are all results of early learning, causing fixation on the wrong species. It's very interesting. We think of imprinting as a single thing, and when it was discovered with birds, as we'll see in the video next class, where Lawrence discovered this in ducks. In the case of the jackdaws, he observed that it's not just related to fixating on a parent. They can be fixated for different functions on different animals. And he wrote a pretty well-known paper. At least it's well-known in German, Der Kumpan und Umwelt der Tiere, but it's roughly translated Companionship in Bird Life. And he describes many of these things in that scientific paper. So, for example, a bird that's imprinted on humans when it reaches sexual maturity may court only humans as potential mates. And he describes jackdaws and the dramatic way these fixations are manifested. In fact, they can be imprinted on a particular human. One became fixated on his a maid that worked for him, but then moved to another location, left his household at work, and the bird eventually found her and tried to mate with her over there. But only for mating. Then it would fly back because it lived at Lawrence's, at an aviary attached to his house. And then he describes this jackdaw, a pet that he called Jock, turned out to be a female actually, courted only humans for mating. But when he wanted to fly, he was fixated on crows, because apparently when he first learned to fly, it was crows flying over that initiated his interest, and he was just learning to fly. He flew with the crows. And he had a lot of trouble getting Jock to give up that habit. So he often would fly with the crows until he became lost. And sometimes Lawrence would go out and make jackdaw calls trying to find Jock, get him to come back. So why would we expect care of young, which we call brood tending in ethology, to be largely innate in many animal species? And like the species we study in the lab. Now, you can take a hamster and breed them, and they can raise young, though they've never been around. They don't grow up in families where they leave the mother after weaning and separate. So they don't live socially. They're solitary. They live in a solitary way, although they do live in proximity to to other hamsters from what we know about them. And it's been difficult to study wild hamsters because they live in Syria. And as you know, Syria's been a difficult place for people from Europe or America to go to study animals. I had one student that went there when it was a little less dangerous, but he still was difficult to get a visa, so he just went in from Lebanon and managed to interact with people there, and he brought back a group of hamsters for the first time since the initial capture of hamsters in the 1930s. But why would it be expected to be innate? And how would you look for learned components of the behavior? Why would it almost have to be innate in many species? Well, because once they mate, you know, they're going to have the babies. If they don't know how to take care of them, you know, if they don't have instinctive ability to take care of them, the babies are not going to survive. So they're not, their reproduction will be unsuccessful. So they have evolved to be able to take care of them in the first try, but it doesn't mean they don't learn anything. Okay? So what do you look for? Some of you are in labs where you're studying mice or rats. I don't think there's any hamsters now, because I don't keep the hamsters anymore, but for years I had them, and it was very evident to me that things were being learned. I can tell you several things. For one is, I would notice that first litters, I would discover injured pups much more frequently. They were handled more roughly by the mother. And if I would separate the mother from the nest, and sometimes I did that because of experiments I was conducting, and then put the mother back, an inexperienced mother, if it was her first litter, would be much more likely to lose her maternal mood altogether. And she would treat her pups like they were insects, and she would attack them. Sometimes that would be brief, and then she would recover her maternal mood and go back. But that almost never happened in second and third litters. And hamsters are capable of having multiple litters. They're very prolific in their reproduction. Let's see what else I wrote here. They, of course, have to be able to do it because the first time they're exposed to young is when they start having them. It's not completely innate in many animals, especially primates, where more is learned. It's not that humans don't have brood-tending instincts, but abnormalities are much more likely in the higher animals because so much more is learned, and some of that learning can not be beneficial for brood tending. Any individual variations you can see among, let's say you have a litter of animals, and you study all the females. All the females, you get them to mate. They all have litters. You will pretty soon see individual differences appearing. You have to be sharp to notice them, but there will be individual differences because there are, even though genetically they're very uniform, hamsters more than just about any other laboratory animal. One reason they're a good experimental animal is because of that genetic uniformity. They all arose from, I believe, a single male and two females that were captured near Aleppo, Syria, by an Israeli scientist named Aharoni, and he introduced them to for laboratory work, and they spread to other countries, including America. Okay, let's talk about a different kind of learning. How do young jackdaws come to recognize predators? A very interesting interaction between innate components and learned components. And Lawrence described his experience with an innate reaction of jackdaws. And you should know that story. I give the pages there. Certain stimuli that could cause the jackdaws in the vicinity to attack him. What was he doing that caused the jackdaws he was rearing, so they were very familiar with him, to start treating him like an enemy?
He would hold a young chick, and the chick had black feathers, or any black object, really.
Didn't even have to be a jackdaw-like object. He could be holding anything black, especially if it was dangling. You know, like a hunter carrying a dead bird. Remember, he said one time he just was removing a roll of film. Of course, film is in a black reel and it looks dark when it comes out of the camera. And he was removing film from a camera. Apparently, it had been exposed. He was going to get rid of it, put new film in. And of course, he unraveled it and there's that dangling thing. And immediately, he was attacked by jackdaws. You know, because they have an innate reaction that's in response to what we call key stimuli. Very simple stimuli usually are all that's necessary to elicit fixed action patterns. It's not that these key stimuli can't change over time, but initially the stimuli are very, very simple. Over time, and some animals do learn, and more complex stimuli come to elicit the behavior. Okay? But with jackdaws, any dark, dangling object will elicit the stimulus. Okay, now, how does learning enter this? What do they learn? Somebody else? Yes.
A call that designates when one of the members of the group sees something that it has previously identified as being vicious or a threat to the population. And so other crows, when they hear this sound, they realize that that sound is a sound that designates the presence of a predator, even if they haven't witnessed the predator actually.
That's right. They start calling, you know, this zick, 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 very raspy kind of sound that jackdaws make. That indicates there's danger. But why would they do that? Humans aren't dangerous to them. It's because once you do something like that and you elicit that innate reaction, it causes the animal to emit that cry, and he actually learns the face of the human. He doesn't react to all humans that way. He reacts to the specific human that did that. They become, quote, enemies of jackdaws. And there are studies done more recently, well, based on the early Lawrence studies, of crows. For example, it started in Japan, some very interesting studies of crow behavior. Not just cognitive behavior, but innate reactions as well. But the studies done in the U.S., and I believe it's been done in other countries too, investigated this. They would elicit that reaction, okay? But they were wearing masks. And the animal learned to recognize that mask and would treat that person like an enemy if he was wearing that mask. So they were able to show that it was very dependent on the specific stimuli. Could even be a different person, but wearing that mask, they were an enemy of crows. The reason they did that experiment was a very interesting one. They wanted to see, could that crow, and I don't know if this has been done with jackdaws, but they're very similar birds, both corvids, both very intelligent, both have very good memories. They wanted to see, could that knowledge of an enemy of crows be passed on to their offspring? So they carefully followed these animals with no more exposure to that mask until the young were old enough, okay, to fly and to make these sounds that would indicate they're recognizing an enemy. And then they started using the mask again. And when no adults were around, they already knew that if the young heard an adult making that sound, responding, and of course they actually are sensitive to eye direction. They will see who the jackdaw is looking at, and the young will learn from the adults. But in this case, they waited until only the young were around. Okay. And they found that if that young had lived with the adult a sufficient amount of time, obviously they didn't even know when the adult had responded to the mask, but if the young was around, could learn from the adult that just the visual shape indicated an enemy. So obviously they had to be exposed in order to learn. But they didn't have to experience the stimulus itself. They never had to see the black dangling object. They only had to hear their parent, and they could learn. So traditions could develop then in a group. It's dangerous to do that around jackdaws. You can become an enemy of jackdaws for a long time. All right. This is an animal, the golden eagle, that are enemies of jackdaws, real enemies of jackdaws. And jackdaws, many birds do have innate responses to certain kinds of flight patterns. Okay, and this, the golden eagle flight pattern is one of those that, with a certain characteristic of their flight, that will elicit escape reactions of various sorts and these cries from various birds. Okay, now what about, can they learn to recognize individuals? We already mentioned that they could recognize individual humans, because if they can recognize an individual human, one particular type of human or a particular mask, as an enemy of jackdaws. But what about other jackdaws? What is the evidence? And it's of several sorts if you study jackdaw social behavior. What was the evidence that Lawrence presents that shows that they can recognize each other? Jackdaws that, unless you really keep jackdaws and you're observing them all the time, they all look pretty similar to you. Okay? But they start looking different when you're very, very familiar with them. Remember in the kittiwake gulls, they had to pay attention to the details of their wing patterns in order to be able to tell them apart. Jackdaws don't have patterns like that. Okay, but they're a little bit different in how heavy they are, the way they fluff their feathers, and their weight, the sheen of their feathers, and they're a little different in their behavior. And all those things can lead to cues that someone watching them all the time can learn to recognize. Hamsters are similar. Very, very difficult to tell them apart. But it's mainly, in fact, unless they're very different in weight, and you can recognize the sexes fairly easily. Otherwise, it's just the behavioral pattern. You learn to tell the difference. Okay? So how do we know jackdaws can recognize much more quickly than humans, in fact, individual jackdaws? What would you look for? Yes, in the back.
There's an established pecking order, which means that
okay.
in order to
Yeah, social dominance rank. Exactly. We call it the pecking order, as you said. Well, they can consistently recognize who's at the bottom, who's in the middle. They recognize their rank with respect to other animals. They know where they are in that pecking order. They know who the dominant jackdaw is. They know the relative rank. They know who his mate is. And generally the female, it's almost always a male, but not always. But let's say it's a male, then that female, once she becomes the mate, that male, she's going to be have the high rank too. And they all learn that very quickly. They know where they fit. Okay. Another way, of course, is when they mate, they recognize their mate. Okay. And they... And, of course, they do recognize friends and enemies. I put enemies in quotes here because if there's any real enemy, then all the jackdaws are friends and they support each other. But otherwise, in normal social behavior, they're more friendly with some birds than others, and this is consistent. It's obvious that they can recognize each other. How do mammals do it? Well, certainly for the very visual animals, the primates, and other very visual animals like giraffes, as an example, they recognize also, use visual cues to recognize individuals. But most mammals, especially nocturnal mammals, olfaction is much more important, and they recognize individual odor patterns. Even animals like dogs. I mean, dogs, different species, different breeds of dog look very different to us. But to dogs, the smell is even more important. Okay, and there's been more formal studies of some of that in crows. A lot of things that Lawrence observed and gave detailed observations about, he did do simple experiments with his jackdaws, but a lot of those have been followed up, not so much with jackdaws, but with other corvids in experimental work, and most of Lawrence's observations have been supported. Okay, in this question, I'm just pointing out that the male jackdaw lacks the plumage of a peacock for displaying towards a female. So then how does the young jackdaw who gets attracted, he falls in love with a female jackdaw, how does he get her attention? And try to get a positive response. It must be through his behavior, right? So he has a specific ceremony for calling a female to his nest. It has auditory components for the way he calls, and it also has visual components. And these do elicit response in other animals if they decide to attend to him. Okay, and if a female begins to, if she's interested in finding a mate too, she will attend more to some males than others. And when she attends, then she will begin to respond to these stimuli. He points out that he noticed sex differences in eye direction, very reminiscent of human behavior. For example, what we call coyness in humans, they attend to, but they don't stare directly at a potential mate. This is the female responding to the male. She doesn't look directly at him. He might be staring at her, but she doesn't look directly. But she's also really attending to him. And this can go on for quite a long time. And how do you tell when a bird's not is looking or not looking. They've got eyes, pretty unless they're owls, they got laterally placed eyes. So they could be seem to be facing over here, but they could still be looking over here. And because their eyes are dark, you can't actually see the pupil. The jackdaws are amazing in their ability to tell what the bird is actually attending to, because the male won't struggle forever to gain the attention of the female if she is totally ignoring him. In fact, she'll eventually just fly away. But if she is interested, she won't fly away, but she won't directly respond for a long time. So how does she respond if she is really interested? How does she get engaged to that male? And Lawrence points out that it happens a full year before they actually start mating. So unlike many species, these animals have this betrothal ceremony a year before they actually start mating. Okay? And what she does is engage in this ritual mating invitation. It's a particular posture. They crouch down, they fluff their feathers in a certain way, widen their wings a little bit. It's used throughout life later as a greeting ceremony in a pair of jackdaws. And Lawrence has some nice drawings of that in the book. Okay, so this is a typical posturing that animals do that has a specific communication function. And then, once they are betrothed, even before they've started to mate, Lawrence describes two behaviors that occur frequently between a pair of jackdaws. And when they pair, how long does it last? You know, many animals will mate with only one animal in a season, but the next season, there's no preference for the original mate. But other animals, it's very different. Some animals are promiscuous even within the mating season. They'll mate with many different animals. But what is it for jackdaws? They're monogamous, generally. They mate for life. Once they mate, that's it. So those early, that early posturing and the displays they show can result in a lifetime of companionship that in jackdaws, which are very long-lived birds, can last, you know, for 20 years. Okay, so because of this, and because once, you could say they're married when they start mating, but their engagement is a full year beforehand, if we use the human terms. And Lawrence uses the human terms pretty freely because it's pretty obvious he's talking about the birds when he's talking about them. So these are the two behaviors then. When these occur, then you know that that pair has formed. The male will feed the female. Okay, and the female will preen the feathers of the male, particularly in the areas of his neck and head that he cannot reach himself. Okay, and they also make these sounds that you don't hear except in this situation and in infant jackdaws. Okay, and it's very common in many different species for courtship to involve these more infantile behaviors. It occurs in humans. Okay, so he describes some of that behavior in more detail. And here's the female getting fed by the male. Literally poked some, or has already finished perhaps putting an insect in her mouth. And this is very common behavior during that courtship period, but it can occur later too, throughout their lives. No, jackdaws are very social and they form close-knit groups, but it doesn't mean they don't squabble. You get conflicts over nest sites, for example, just like the kittiwakes. Some nest sites are a lot more conveniently placed than others, so they will fight to get them. Each male has to establish a nest site. And attract his female to it. And the conflicts are often settled by the kinds of postures or displays, aggressive displays they make. Or they can, similarly there are defensive displays that will stop the aggressiveness of the attacker. So they will do this at a nest site, and when they engage in this very loud calling, it's apparently in one season of the year, which in Altenburg, Germany is February and March, the whole town is filled with this loud zick, 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 zicking of the jackdaws. So what happens if the defending jackdaw is actually attacked, and that does happen, where a jackdaw stops just his aggressive posturing and decides, hey, I've got a real chance to get this nest site, and he attacks the bird. He perceives him as weaker. What happens? Yeah. Is there a louder? Yeah, it actually results in a melee. You know, it gets all the birds involved. They all start this. They start the zig-zig sounds becomes louder, and pretty soon there's a whole congregation of animals making this noise, and pretty soon it gets so confusing that even the animal that was initially attacking or defending, they'll all start doing it, and it's totally confusing. Even the guy who started it, he's joining that crowd, and pretty soon it all just gradually goes back to normal. And they all become unaggressive again. See, they've got this built-in social behavior that protects them from too much damage by actual social attacks. And many species have this. And humans have it too. We ruined it by developing weapons. Because then we don't have to face somebody. We can kill them at a distance. Terrible thing. Just think if animals had guns. So most animals have these means. It's not that animals never kill each other, but it's very rare. Okay? There are also innate responses to get a young one who, when he's flying, becomes very adventurous and very energetic and might fly so far from home that he gets lost and it will be difficult for him even to find his way back. So the older jackdaws will try to entice a young one that's missing. They will find him, and they, of course, have very good vision. They can fly up and often find the young that are straying so far. How do they get them to come back? And it's done by, again, a combination of the auditory and the visual stimuli. They have this fly with me call, the kya kya sound, and it changes a little bit to what Lawrence calls it, a kya sound, slightly different in the way it sounds. And then, so they will make this sound flying at the young bird, and then they will turn and fly away. And as they fly away, that produces a visual stimulus that the young jackdaw finds very hard not to follow. And so the combination of that loud sound they're making plus the way they're flying serves as innate releasing stimuli, we would call them. Provide the key stimulus to get the following response, and they fly after the older animal. All right, so What time are we at here? Let's, I'm going to go, I didn't put this in the journal file. I will go to the PowerPoint. Because I want to get started here with more specific discussion of innate behavior. The technical term in ethology is the fixed action pattern. And that will lead to a little bit of discussion of the central nervous system. We won't be talking a lot about the CNS, but we will talk about it. And next time I will show you the film. It's from a TV program, The Wild, Wild World of Animals, but it's a historic film that shows Lawrence and his ducks that were imprinted on him. And then the film goes on to talk. It films some of the work of Lawrence and his students and co-workers showing natural response to predators by geese, and some of the work they've done on imprinting and the effects on social life by geese. And this, we'll talk about innate responses. I'll go through this next time, some of the stimuli they use. But let's talk about fixed action patterns, and we have at least time to define it. And this will come up again in the class, and I can tell you many students get confused about some of this, so I like to go through it more than once. What is a fixed action pattern? When we think of a fixed action pattern, it sounds like we're just talking about what to the ethologist is only one component of the fixed action pattern, the motor pattern, the fixed motor pattern, an innate sequence of behavior. Okay? These are examples in the human. Smiling, frowning, many other expressions of emotion. They're the same or very similar in all humans, in different cultures, in fact. They're similar, as Ibisfeld showed, in humans that have never seen another human doing it because they were born blind or even born blind and deaf, and yet they do it. Walking is another fixed action pattern. It's a particularly important multipurpose pattern of action. Eye blink and swallowing are fixed action patterns. But why are we calling them fixed action patterns? Those last two, eye blink and swallowing, are, if you read in a medical text, they're called reflexes, swallowing reflex. Swallowing reflex and eye blink reflex. So is a fixed action pattern any different from a reflex? Isn't it just a more complex reflex? So we'll call that a reflex if it's something very simple, like withdrawal of the limb from a painful stimulus. Okay? But we'll call it a fixed action pattern if it's a more complex sequence. And the author of that little book I'm having you read, Graham Scott, actually that's the way he uses the term. All he means is complex. He really just means automatic. That's what he means by reflex. It's something that happens automatically with a certain stimulus. But is that not what a fixed action pattern is? And the answer is no. We will follow Connor Lawrence in talking about it. Okay? I want you to learn the Lawrence view, which distinguishes pretty clearly between fixed action pattern and reflex. A reflex is something that's always there, no matter what my motivational state. When I'm walking, I'm responding in a reflex way to stimuli from my feet. If I'm on uneven terrain, I adjust my gait to the terrain. Some species do that much better than others, like a goat does it much better, or a donkey, in fact, does it much better, or a mule does it much better than a horse, because horses evolved to run on the plains. These other animals evolved to live in hillier terrain, So we talk about some animals being more sure-footed than others. That's just a difference in the reflex patterns that they've inherited. Okay? But why am I saying those are reflexes? Because a reflex is something, it's like a mantle you're always wearing. Doesn't matter whether you're hungry or not hungry, whether you're horny or not horny. No matter what your motivational state, you still have those same reflexes. Okay? It's a background. That's why we call it just a mantle. You always have that. But what about a fixed action pattern? It has a motivational component, okay? So I go through that here. A component of the fixed action pattern is what Lawrence called, and different psychologists have used different names for this. In the West, we often just talk about a drive or level of motivation. But the ethologists following Lawrence have been much more specific. He calls it an action-specific potential, something in the brain that can change in its level. It's specific to a specific action, a specific motor pattern. Okay? It's an internal level of activation of a drive or a central motivational state. It's been called the central motive state by the psychologist Peter Milner. He was a physiological psychologist, or is, in Canada. Many people here just call it a drive. Now, the action-specific potential for most fixed action patterns builds up pretty steadily over time. Okay? And what that does, it increases the probability of discharge of the motor pattern. How it does that is the thresholds for eliciting the fixed motor pattern become lowered. And in fact, they can get so low, if the level of drive is very, very high, that almost any stimulus can elicit them. And when that happens, we can say, well, it's like they're discharged in a vacuum, almost no stimulus. But all it is this extreme lowering of thresholds for eliciting the fixed action pattern. That doesn't happen with reflexes. The threshold for eliciting reflex does change with current conditions. Like, you know, the tendency to withdraw my limb, well, the tendency will increase if I'm frightened. Say I go into a dark basement and somebody tells me there are rats down there, I'm going to be much more likely to withdraw if I touch something I wasn't expecting. But it's not a fixed action pattern. It's a simple reflex whose threshold has been adjusted by the current situation. Okay, but in the motivational level, the fixed action pattern will change steadily over time, regardless of the situation. The stimuli you're exposed to, though, can be the major way that its threshold will change. Its level of activation will change. So in that way, it is a little similar to a reflex. Okay, so that's the end of the hour. We're going to come back to this slide next time. Okay, and start there after we see the film.